Thank you very much to Anna Marmododo for the invitation to participate in this conference. Thank you all for being here. I have a massive handout. I don't know if you have a copy of it. It's not just a handout, it's the paper itself, so you can follow the argument if you have a copy of the paper. So I have 45, 50 minutes?
Yeah. Okay. As long as it's under an hour.
Me too. Very well. Well, in this paper, I deal with two classic problems in the Stoic theory of time. The first problem concerns the reality of the present. Is the present something distinct from the past and the future? Or is any time either past or future? The second problem relates to the connection between time and change. Does the passage of time require change? The Stoics seem to hold contradictory views on each of these questions. So my aim is to prove that, contrary to appearances, the Stoic theory of time is fully internally consistent. So the first problem, what is the problem? No? The first problem is an apparent contradiction or tension between two claims about the present. One is C1, the claim that no time is wholly present, utheis holos enistatai chronos. And the second claim, C2, is that some times are present after all, as opposed to past or future, namely those that the Stoics call broadly present, enestanai kataplatos. As we shall see, the tension between these two claims is the following. C1 implies that any putative present is infinitely divisible into parts that aren't themselves present, but are either past or future. So if C2 is consistent with C1, then any broadly present, because it is present, must be infinitely divisible too into parts that are either past or future. But then, how can the broad present be present in any substantive sense if it is fully divisible into parts that are not present? So that's the problem, I think. And the solution I will give to the problem is the following. The solution is that the Stoics hold that the presentness of the broad present, namely that which explains why it is present, is not that its parts are themselves present, because they aren't, but another factor. I mean, the explanation lies elsewhere, and I won't tell you where, because I will keep the suspense for the end. But there is another factor, no? And the presentness of the broad present doesn't consist in its parts being present because they aren't. No. In other words, C2 uses a notion of the present different from the notion in C1, according to which the presentness of a time does consist in its parts being present. There are two notions of presentness, I think. So I begin by examining each of these two claims, C1 and C2, in sections 2 and 3, and then develop the solution in section 4. Now, given that both C1 and C2 are attested for Chrysippus, as we shall see, I shall refer to the theory to which they both belong as Chrysippus's theory of the present. Very well, so C1. At first sight, the claim C1, no time is wholly present, utheis holos enistatai chronos, is ambiguous between two things. Between the idea that no time is such that the whole of it is present. In other words, any time is such that at least some of the parts into which it is divisible are past or future, but some may be present. And the other idea is that any time is such that the whole of it is not present, i.e. any time is such that any part into which it is divisible is either past or future. The right meaning of C1 is not 1 but 2, as is clear from the argument the Stoics provide to support C1. So the argument comes in three passages. The first one is Stobios, the passage says, but he, Chrysippus, he's talking about Chrysippus, says most clearly that no time is wholly present. For since continuous things are infinitely divisible, on the basis of this division, every time too is infinitely divisible. Consequently, no time is present exactly, but it is broadly said to be so. In T2, there is also a reference to this argument. In On Parts, books 3, 4, and 5, he, Chrysippus, maintains that one part of the present is future and the other part past. And then comes a longer passage that doesn't attribute these views to the to Chrysippus, but to the Stoics in general. But the passage is more informative about how the argument goes. It's a Plutarch passage, as I said. It says, it is contrary to the common conception to hold that future and past time exist, while present time does not, but that recently and the other day subsist, while now is nothing at all. Yet, this is the result for the Stoics, who do not admit a minimal time, or wish the now to be partless, but claim that whatever one thinks one has grasped and is considering as present, is in part future and in part past. Consequently, no part of a present time corresponding to now remains or is left. If the time said to be present is distributed into parts that are future and parts that are past. So T1 formulates the claim and gives a rough idea of the argument. T2 also refers to the argument but in an abbreviated form, and T3, as I said earlier, gives a fuller version of the argument. Well, the authorship of the argument, according to T2, the authorship of the argument goes back to Chrysippus. But the claim that no time is wholly present, and the argument for it, was also endorsed by Posidonius in the same text from Stobaeus, a bit later. And the claim in T2 that continuous quantities, ta synechonta, are infinitely divisible, meaning not that continua are made of infinitely many actual parts, but of infinitely many potential parts. This idea is also well attested for Chrysippus. Now, the argument seems to work in five basic steps. First, think of a putatively present time, such as the time occupied by my present talk, and divide it into parts. On inspection, some of these parts are in fact future. For example, the time occupied by my reading the conclusion of the paper. And some are past. For example, the time occupied by my reading the introduction. So, second, put aside these parts and focus on a shorter segment that does not seem to have parts that are past or future. For example, the time occupied by my reading the present section of the paper. However, three, on inspection, if you divide this shorter segment into parts, you notice again that some are future, some parts are future. For example, my reading its last paragraph, and some are past. For example, my reading its first paragraph. So, and four, the same applies to any shorter putatively present time. Any shorter putatively present time. Therefore, five, no time is wholly present. So I think the central intuition of the argument is straightforward. However much we narrow down a putative present by present time by leaving aside the potential parts of it that are past or future, the shorter segment is also divisible, and any part of it is also either past or future. Now, it is clear that the intended conclusion of the argument, the claim C1 that no time is wholly present, is that any time is such that the whole of it is not present, i.e. it is such that any part into which it is divisible is either past or future. Now, I think that this argument poses a real threat, a philosophical threat, to the reality of the present. For how can a time be present if the parts into which it is divisible are not themselves present, but either past or future? No. So the challenge is to find an alternative account of the presentness of time Because only so will we be able of doing two important things. First, to do justice to the intuition captured in C2 that there are present times, while be granting the apparently correct conclusion reached by the argument above that any putative present is infinitely divisible into parts that are either past or future. So to meet this challenge, we need to look at the notion of broadly present times, which is the claim C2. So what is a broadly present time? Now, the definition, as this is something I will argue for in this section, but the definition of a broadly present time is this, is a time is broadly present if and only if it is occupied by an actual event. For example, the 40 minutes time occupied by my present talk is broadly present because my present talk is an actual event. In contrast, the 1 month period of time occupied by the 20th FIFA World Cup in Brazil is not broadly present because it is occupied by an event that is no longer actual. And likewise, the 1 month time occupied by the 21st FIFA World Cup in Russia is not broadly present because it is occupied by an event that is not yet actual. Now, before I go any further, I would like to make some remarks on the Stoic notion of event. Right? So, how do the Stoics construe events? Events, for example, things such as my giving this talk, events are entities that the Stoics construe or analyze in terms of a body disposed in a certain way or somehow disposed, a pos echon, the idea being that when a body is disposed in a certain way, the body satisfies a certain predicate, categorema, which becomes an actual attribute, simply the cause of the body. Example, my giving this talk is my being disposed in a certain, the event consisting in my giving this talk, this, is my being disposed in a certain way, and thanks to my being disposed in this way, I satisfy the predicate, categorema, gives a talk, which is then a current attribute of mine. I will give the evidence in a short while. These dynamic predicates, although I'm not sure about this, but the evidence is very thin, very scarce. No, these dynamic predicates, such as walks or gives a talk or whatever, dynamic predicates, as opposed to static predicates, such as is read, are called happenings, in Greek symbamata. So look at T4 and T5. T4, it's part of a longer passage in which it classifies the different kinds of lecta. No? And it says, well, of predicates, some are happenings, symbamata. For example, to sail through rocks. No? Or again, T5, Apollonius Discolus. Every infinitive is a verbal name, if indeed the Stoics call it a verb, but call walks around or writes a predicate or a happening. So the evidence about symbamata is a bit fizzy, but not very clear, I think. But anyhow, events are analyzed by the Stoics in terms of bodies disposed in a certain way. And in virtue of being disposed in that way, they satisfy certain predicates. So, now, what is the evidence that a time is broadly present if and only if it is occupied by an actual event? Now, there is a problem, as nearly always, with the sources, because the notion of a broadly present time is only attested in T1, which is the first passage I read. But T1 doesn't define the notion. It doesn't say what is a broadly present time. There are, however, some texts that give an idea of the general conditions needed for a time to be present. For example, look at T6. So, if there are general conditions for a time to be present, these conditions must apply to the broadly present time. Right, so, look at T6. It's a text from Stobius. The text says, he, Chrysippus, says that only the present belongs. hyparche, right? The past and the future subsist, but belong in a way. Just as only predicates which are actual attributes are said to belong. For instance, walking around belongs to me when I'm walking around, but it doesn't belong when I am lying down or sitting. The thesis reported here also belong to a section devoted to Chrysippus. No, so it's Chrysippian doctrine that we have here. And the passage has two key elements. The first one is a criterion for determining when a time is present. A time is present if and only if it belongs, otherwise it is either past or future. I think that's clear. That, no? And the other element is an analogy between time and predicates like walks, i.e. between times and happenings, Simbamata. However, the analogy is obscure. There is a weak and a strong interpretation of it. On the weak interpretation, the analogy is a mere comparison. Both times and predicates may either belong or subsist. That, and that's it. There is no further parallel being drawn here. But on a strong interpretation, which is conjectural, but I sympathize very much with this interpretation, the analogy implies a correlation between the belonging of times and the belonging of predicates. This interpretation was first proposed by A.C. Lloyd, and then subscribed by Richard Sorabji, who is here, and Malcolm Schofield. Now, what is a correlation? The correlation has two parts. The first part is that for any time t, t belongs and is present. It has two parts because it's a biconditional, right? So for any time t, t belongs and is present if A, there is a predicate P such that P belongs to somebody B, because P is a current attribute of B. And second, B, T is the time at which P belongs to B. So here A and B, these two conditions, are jointly sufficient for the time to belong. Example, if the predicate climbs the Everest belongs to me at T, then T belongs or is present. I think that the idea behind one is apparently that the present is the only time at which predicates may belong to bodies, i.e. predicates do not belong to bodies in the future or the past. Of course, it may happen that a predicate belonged in the past to a body. I'm sorry. So it may happen that a predicate belonged to a body in the past. For instance, wins the Battle of Austerlitz belonged to Napoleon in 1805. But it doesn't currently belong to him because Napoleon's winning the Battle of Austerlitz is no longer actual. We could say that it is still actual if the past were a sort of place different from the world where we exist, in which Napoleon currently exists and wins the Battle of Austerlitz. But I mean, that's, I think, alien to Stoic ontology. And the second part is that for any time t belongs and is present only if there is a predicate that currently belongs to somebody, right? And t is the time at which p belongs, this predicate belongs to this body. The idea behind two is simply that a time where nothing happened, nothing were the case, i.e. a time where the existing bodies didn't satisfy any predicate, then that time wouldn't be present. I return to this later in the paper. Now, how does T6 apply to broadly present times? So, assuming that the strong interpretation of TC is correct, you know, in terms of this biconditional, then T6 gives general conditions for a time to be present. Therefore, the broadly present times of T1, if they are to be present at all, must satisfy these conditions. And so T6 is good evidence that a time is broadly present if and only if it is occupied by an actual event. But again, this interpretation is conjectural because the text doesn't say that explicitly, of course. Now, more explicit evidence comes from T7. T7 is another text that lends support to the idea that broadly present times are occupied by actual events. It says Scolion in Dionysius Thrax. I think it's, that's how you pronounce the name. So the text says, it's SVF 2.165. The Stoics define the present as extended present because it extends to the future. For he who says, I do, manifests both that he did something and that he will do it. So T7 doesn't attribute the theory to any particular Stoic, but to the Stoics in general. So it may reflect Cresippian views, I think. And T7 makes a grammatical point about tense. It's a grammatical thesis, no? It's a grammatical treatise text and everything. So the main point about T7 is grammatical. And it's a grammatical point about tense. No? Any action verb in the present tense, for example, I do, refers to a period of time that starts in the present and ends in the future. Now, it is clear from the text that the presentness of the extended present derives from the fact that the extended present is occupied by an actual action that starts in the present and extends to the future. I mean, the present is extended because the action that occupies it is also extended. So, assuming that the extended present in T7 is Chrysippus's broad present, then T7 too is evidence that Chrysippus's broad present is occupied by actual events. So our initial question, where does the presentness of the broad present reside? Well, the broad present is infinitely divisible into parts that are either past or future. And in fact, you can notice that the parts into which the broad present is divisible are not themselves broadly present. For example, the time occupied by my reading the introduction of this talk, which is a part of the time occupied by my giving this talk, an actual event, right? So that part of the time occupied by my giving this talk is the time occupied by my reading the introduction of this talk. This time is not itself broadly present because my reading the introduction is not itself an actual event. So, right? So the parts of broadly present times are not themselves broadly present. Therefore, of course, the presentness of the broad present doesn't reside in its parts being broadly present because they aren't. No? And so this is not what distinguishes them from past and future events. The presentness of the broad present resides rather in its being occupied by an actual event, which is to say that to decide whether a time is broadly present, we must determine whether the event that occupies it is actual or not. So one last question. What is the Stoic criterion for determining whether an event is actual? Well, they seem to have one. No? An event E is actual if and only if it has causal powers. In other words, if and only if, one, E is the causal outcome of prior events, and two, E determines the occurrence of later events. So an event that satisfies these two conditions is actual, otherwise it isn't. So this conception of actual events is strongly suggested by the Stoic picture of how the events that actually happen, the gignomena, are causally connected to prior and later events. See, for example, text T8 in the appendix, but especially see T9, which is a text that I put here from Alexander Fafrodisias de Fato. No, it's a classic text on causation and determinism. It says, and in this way, all things in the cosmos are bound together, and neither does anything happen in the cosmos such that something else doesn't unconditionally follow from it and become causally attached to it, nor can any of the latter events be severed from the preceding events so as not to follow from one of them as if bound fast to it. But from everything that happens, something else follows. Everything that happens, that's an actual event, right? With a necessary causal dependence on it, and everything that happens, again, actual event, everything that happens has something prior to it with which it is it causally coheres. Very well. So, in sum, broadly present times are infinitely divisible into parts that are either past or future, as required by C1. However, they are present in the sense that they are occupied by actual events, and this is why they are clearly distinct from past and future times, as required by C2. Past and future times are occupied by events, but not actual ones. And so that's the difference between the present, past, and future. Now, we may move on to the second problem, which is, as you will see, closely connected to this one. The second problem concerns the relation between time and change. Does the passage of time require the change of the things that exist in time? Here, too, the Stoics seem to hold contradictory views. On the one hand, there seems to be evidence that for the Stoics, the passage of time does require change. And what I mean is this, is that for any two successive times, T1 and T2, T1 and T2 are different times only if the bodies that exist at T1 differ in their qualities and or dispositions or properties from those that exist at T2. Right. So, in order for two successive times to be really different and successive, the bodies that exist in each of them must differ in their qualities and dispositions. Otherwise, T1 and T2 are not different times. So, I call this claim C3. And there seems to be evidence that the Stoics are committed to this claim C3. Sorry. Right. Now, but on the other hand, their doctrine of everlasting recurrence seems to allow for the passage of time without change. For this doctrine rests on two central claims. C4, the cosmos, the present cosmos, namely the cosmos that was generated at the latest cosmogony and that will end at the next conflagration, the present cosmos, this cosmos, will repeat itself infinitely many times in the future and has been repeated infinitely many times in the past. And C5, at each cycle, the cosmos is repeated without variation. This is a further claim. No? The bodies that exist at any one cycle have the same qualities and dispositions as those that exist in any other cycle. Well, we shouldn't forget that later Stoics proposed identity claims weaker than C5, which is only found, C5 namely, it is only found in what seems to be the first and original version. Now, the contradiction between C3, C4, and C5, I think, is clear. No? Suppose that, one, the time occupied by the present cosmic cycle and the time occupied by the next cosmic cycle are two successive times. Let's suppose that. But suppose that the bodies that exist at the present cycle and the bodies that exist at the next have the same qualities and dispositions. And suppose further that time requires change. If so, then the present cycle occurs at the same time as the next. But if so, the time of the present cycle and the time of the next cannot be successive, which contradicts one. So I'm here talking about the time of the cosmic cycle as a whole, as a period of time. And this very long period of time is, as we will see, is broadly present, right? So you can speak of the time of the present cycle as a time, as opposed to the time of the next cycle. They are. That's one assumption in the argument. But we'll go back to this. Now, the proposed solution is that, well, that no contradiction arises, really, because, in fact, the Stoics never subscribed the view C3 that time requires change. No? And to prove that they did not, I argue that their definitions of time do not imply this view. Now, before we look at these definitions, I want briefly to present our main source for the doctrine of everlasting recurrence. It's this famous passage from Nemesius. It's a long passage. It says, the Stoics say that when the planets return to the same celestial sign in length and in breadth, where each was originally when the cosmos was first formed, at set periods of time they cause conflagration and destruction of existing things. Once again, the cosmos returns anew to the same condition as before, and when the stars are moving again in the same way, each of the things that occurred in the previous period will come to pass indiscernibly from its previous occurrence. For again, there will be Socrates and Plato, and each one of mankind with the same friends and fellow citizens. They will suffer the same things, and every city and village and piece of land return in the same way. The periodic return of everything occurs not once, but many times, or rather, the same things return infinitely and without end. The gods, who are not subject to destruction, from their knowledge of this single period, know from it everything that is going to be in the next periods. For there will be nothing strange in comparison with what occurred previously, but everything will be just the same and indiscernible, down to the smallest details. Now, T10, this text, is good evidence for C4. No, the present cosmos will repeat itself infinitely many times in the future and has been repeated infinitely many times in the past. And for C5, the bodies that exist at any one cycle have the same qualities and dispositions as those that exist in any other cycle. Regarding C4, the passage is emphatic. The cosmos is restored not once but many times, uk hapax ala polakis, and even infinitely and without end, eis aperon kai ateleutetos. The intended difference is clearly temporal. The cycles ahead of us are future, melonta. And regarding C5, the passage is also quite emphatic. The bodies are of the present cycle are the same, ta'auta, as those of future cycles in two fundamental respects, at least two. First, again, there will be Socrates, Plato, and each one of mankind, which implies that they are the same bodies peculiarly qualified. No, they are the same individual bodies. And second, they will suffer the same things and they will encounter the same things, and also they will put their hand onto the same things, which implies that they are the same bodies somehow disposed. I mean, they behave in the same way. Now, before we move on, we must deal with one puzzling element in the text, which is the claim that the bodies of the present cycle are indiscernible or exist indiscernibly, aparallactos, from those of other cycles. Well, this is very puzzling because if they exist at different times, as the text says, how can they be indiscernible as the text also says? I mean, the text says both things clearly. So how can it say both things? Well, apparently it cannot say both things, because if, one, the bodies that exist in the present cycle are indiscernible from those of other cycles, there must be nothing that distinguishes them from those of other cycles. But ex hypothesi, the former and the latter exist at different times. And if they exist at different times, there is something that distinguishes them from each other. Therefore, they cannot be really indiscernible. That's the problem with the text. No? Now, this argument, however, is unsound. No? I mean, there is no contradiction in the text, I think. Because from a Stoic perspective, premises 1 and 3 of this argument are false, because the time of existence is not an attribute that is relevant for determining whether two bodies are discernible or indiscernible. The reason is that, in general terms, the Stoic principle of the identity of indiscernibles concerns qualities and dispositions. If A and B have the same qualities and dispositions, then A and B are the same entity. It is qualities and dispositions that the Stoics regard as relevant for the individuation of bodies. But the time of occurrence is not a quality, and is therefore irrelevant for discernibility, because Stoic qualities are bodies and time is incorporeal. So, thus, any two cycles can be discernible from each other and yet exist at different times, because their different times of existence do not matter for their indiscernibility. Now, the idea that indiscernibility is compatible with time difference is reflected in T10, clearly, I think, through how God is supposed to know future cycles. Remember that according to T10, God's knowledge of future cycles is based on his knowledge of present cycles, because he knows that they are indiscernible. I mean, God knows that they are indiscernible, and therefore this knowledge allows him to know what will happen in future cycles. Now, see the two final sentences. From their knowledge of this single period, the gods know from it everything that is going to be in the next periods. For everything will be just the same as in this, and just the same and indiscernible down to the smallest details. Example: God knows that Neil Armstrong walks on the moon on the 20th of July 1969 of the present cycle. He knows that, and given that God also knows that the present cycle is indiscernible from the next, he concludes that Neil Armstrong will walk on the moon on the 20th of July 1969 of the next cycle. Now, I think this is relevant because if God's knowledge of future cycles, qua future, of course, is based on the indiscernibility between these cycles and the present cycle, then indiscernibility cannot require that they all exist at the same time. Now, how does God know which cosmic cycle is present and which cosmic cycles are future or past, if they are indiscernible, no? And how does he know within those that are not present the order in which they come about? For example, how does he know which cosmic cycle is the next and which cosmic cycle is the one after the next? No? I think the question is relevant because if they are only discernible, as I said, then how does God know which is which? Answers to these questions may be gathered from Chrysippus' theory of the present. Regarding the first question, God can know that a given cosmic cycle C is broadly present, namely, if he knows that C is actual. As for the second question, God knows that a given cycle C star is the next, if he knows that C star hasn't begun yet, but that it will do so once C is over. Likewise, he knows that a given cosmic cycle C double star is the one after the next, if he knows that C double star begins once C star is over, and so on. And by parity of reasoning, the same applies to the order of past cycles. Now, I'm not sure if I will have the time to go through all the definitions, but just to have a quick look at two of them. So, I have argued that the Stoic doctrine of everlasting recurrence presupposes the possibility of time without change. I now want to prove that this doctrine is fully in accordance with the Stoic definitions of time, because these definitions do not deny the possibility of time without change. There are two main definitions as far as I can see. One is D1, time is the interval of change, kinesios diastema, or the interval accompanying the change of the cosmos, to parakolothun diastema tetu kosmu kinesei. And the other is time is the measure of the speed and slowness of change, metron tachus kai bradutetos. Well, if you look at T12 and T13, for example, T12 is a passage from Simplicius, no? Aristotle says that time is the number of change, whereas of the Stoics, Zeno said time is the dimension of all motion without qualification. But Chrysippus said that it is the dimension of the world's motion. And T13, Chrysippus said time is the dimension of motion according to which the measure or of speed and slowness is spoken of, or the dimension accompanying the world's motion. And he says every single thing moves and exists in accordance with time, unless time is spoken of in two ways, just as earth and the sea and the void are spoken of, namely, as wholes and as the parts of them. Just as the void in its totality is infinite in every respect, so time in its totality is infinite on either side, for both the past and the future are infinite. So, I think that D1 doesn't imply that time requires change. No? In the use of the term interval in Stoic physics, an interval actually occupied by an x is not necessarily occupied by that particular x, or by some x of the same type. Therefore, the idea that a time is the interval of change is consistent with the idea that this time is not necessarily occupied by that change or by some change. No? So in T14 and T15, I look at evidence showing that the content of an interval is contingent. And in connection with D1, I think that nothing suggests that the Stoics accepted Aristotle's idea that time follows a colouthe change in the specific sense that it is essentially something dependent on change. No? There is this famous passage in the physics discussed by Ursula Kupp, who is here. No? Chrysippus, I think, uses a similar verb in T13, which is parakolouthein. Time is the interval consequent upon the change of the cosmos. But I think that this merely states a conditional claim. If a change occurs, then an interval of time also occurs. And in this conditional claim, the passage of time appears as a necessary condition for the occurrence of change. The occurrence of change does not appear as a necessary condition for the passage of time as required by C3. So it's the other way around. And furthermore, there is at least one passage suggesting that the Stoics sometimes use the expression being consequent upon to mean applies to, without ontological implications. For example, in this passage from Philo, no? De Sobrietate 37, it says VF 3:2:44, where blame and praise are said to be consequent upon those who act and are active as opposed to those who merely can act, in the sense that we blame and praise those who are active. No? But there is no ontological presupposition there. So I think I'll just read then the overall conclusion of the talk, So to end, I wish to bring together the two problems and ask if the solutions envisaged for each are consistent with each other. One question in particular is this: is Chrysippus' theory of the present, which is the sum of claims C1 and C2, compatible with the possibility of time without change? Well, I believe it is. Chrysippus' theory of the present is designed to determine when a time is present, past or future, the criterion being that a time is broadly present if and only if the event that occupies it is actual. Otherwise, the time is either past or future. But this criterion of presentness surely doesn't require that the event that occupies the broad present be different from those that occupy the past or the future. It only requires that these events be actual and that those that occupy the past and the future are not actual. No? Now, for example, suppose that I give this talk three consecutive times. One last month, one now, no? And one next month. The same event is repeated three times. But only now it is actual. This is sufficient, in Chrysippus' theory, for the time occupied by this actual event to be broadly present, and also sufficient for the other two times not to be broadly present. So, you don't need a difference in the events in order to distinguish past from future, present from past and from future. You just need the actuality of what happens at the present time and the non-actuality of what happens in the past or the future. In some, Chrysippus' theory of the present doesn't require that successive times be occupied by different events and is therefore fully compatible with the time, well, with the possibility of time without change. And there are two appendices, one at the very end of the paper, one about the position of Apollodorus, which is interesting, which is he has a different theory of the present than Chrysippus's, I think. That's in Appendix B. And in Appendix C, I deal with two passages, T16 and T17, which seem to imply that time does require a change, but I show that the evidence is too problematic in order to be reliable. I stick to the conclusion that time doesn't require change for the Stoics. Well, thank you very much.